I think we also live in this time where information is so accessible and there's really no hierarchy anymore. You can just Google search a Rubens painting or an emoji teardrop. Like, it's all leveled. You don't really have to fly across the world to see these masterpieces in person. We see so much through a screen, for better or for worse. And I want to talk about that leveling in my work.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is Alison Zuckerman, actually a re-air from a past episode on the occasion of the two-person exhibition by Evelyn Axel and Alison Zuckerman. Evelyn Axel is a pop artist from Belgium who passed away in a car crash in 1972. And we present the two female painters in this two-person exhibition at the Königgalerie St. Agnes Nave in a conversation on female representation and painting. And in this occasion, we re-air Alison's conversation and invite you to see the exhibition Power Shift. Evelyn Axel is also in the MoMA collection and works with painting of machinery and the role of the women and did performances. Listen to Alison's remarks, how she got into painting and also how she relates to art history. And I think then it's clear why that's a good match. Enjoy. Welcome, Alison.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Alison, tell me, what drives me most in this podcast is to understand how my guests started to be aware of art. Like, when did art come into your life?
I think there were a few pivotal moments. The real start was when I was 4 years old. I have an older sister, and I would often do whatever she was doing. So if she took piano lessons, I did piano. If she took karate, I took karate. And she started taking art lessons on Saturday mornings. And I was very curious about it, and I saw what she was bringing home, and it looked lovely and interesting to me. And I told my mom I wanted to go also, but I was a little too young. I think the classes were available for children as young as six, but they made an exception for me, and I went. And apparently I made a oil pastel drawing of a queen, and my parents thought it was my sister who had made it because there was it seemed, you know, too good for a little four-year-old kid to make it. And from there, I just kept taking the classes, and my parents were very supportive. I never stopped making work. I would come home from school and go down to the basement and make art, and then finish that and do homework at the last second. So that's how I began. But I think the first time art really struck me on an intellectual level was when I found Eric Fischel paintings in a book. And I was just perusing books in a library, and I saw a painting of, I think it was called Bad Boy, and he was stealing, the little boy was stealing out of a woman's purse. And it was a painting of a woman, a nude woman on a bed, and the light was coming in through the windows, casting a beautiful shadow in between the blinds. So she had these like striations on her body. And this little boy was going through her bag while looking at her. And I thought it was just so strange and jarring. And I couldn't believe that paintings could be made like that. That also really informed the way that I looked at work and opened things up for me, that paintings didn't have to be so traditional. It didn't have to be just a portrait or a landscape or still life. It could be very psychologically evocative.
And then also the energy a painting can unfold, obviously.
Right. And it just really stuck in my mind. And it felt more like a novel than just an image. And I kept wondering what was happening. And I liked that there was enough information to feel startled, but it also left so much to my own imagination to draw my own conclusions.
This actually even worked with a pure reproduction because you saw the painting in a book, right? You didn't see, right. Did you ever see that painting in the flesh?
I never did.
Interesting.
I had a friend the other day who grew up in the communist regime, and he went to Mexico and saw these paintings for the first time. I mean, that could happen to anybody who looked at art history books from the 60s and 70s. But he said that he finally saw these paintings in Rio because he only studied them with black and white photography. Wow. And thought that they still then unfolded the energy despite the fact that they were without color. But it's interesting what you say with your sister. That also motivated me opening my gallery, because my brother moved to New York and opened a gallery, and that totally drove me to kind of mimic him. Is your sister still in the arts as well?
It's actually funny. She is she's a radiologist specializing in breast imaging. Her mother-in-law made a joke that we both specialize in examining the woman's body.
That's a very visual job, yeah. Yes, the woman's body, it's also what came up to my mind now, is because you work a lot with the art history and the history of painting in your work and contemporary image culture, I would say, but I don't think I ever spotted an Eric Fischer reference in your paintings.
I think I have some of his beach figures in the backgrounds.
Ah, okay.
And then mixed with Cezanne bathers.
Yeah, let's just right dive into your practice. So you mentioned the female body and some references. So how did you get to the practice you are working on today? Because I think the most challenging for artists is to first find the need, what they want to say, and then they need to find the language, how to say it. And you are very precise conceptually, but also visually. How did you get there? So what was a starting point of your practice?
So I went to a broad-based liberal arts college, and I decided to major in art. The school that I went to, University of Pennsylvania, is known for business and finance. So when I would tell people I was studying fine art, they automatically assumed I said finance. It was an unusual pursuit. But while in college, I really focused on refining my painting skills. And I would paint from photographs, and I would paint close-up details of faces or cropped portraits, often in exaggerated poses, so like a grimace, a sneeze, somebody looking shocked. And I really enjoyed painting this way, but I found it to be a dead end. So I would just render until it looked like the photograph, and that was the end point. When I went to grad school, I took these paintings with me, and I actually started cutting them up and then putting them with other paintings. And I found that was much more interesting to me.
You cut them up physically?
I physically cut up paintings. I also took photographs of those paintings and cut them up as well. And I thought, now I'm getting somewhere. This is like an interesting discovery. Lips that didn't go with eyes, you know, one was too big, but it was much more interesting to me than just rendering. But photography has always been important to me. And I got a phone when I was 14 years old. So I've always had a phone with me as well. And I've known that like the digital informs my everyday life. I'm not without the digital. So figuring out a way to unite the digital with the traditionally slow method of painting was a challenge to me. And I wanted it to feel collaborative, but also I wanted it to compete too, in the way that painting has to compete with the digital. So in graduate school, I went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and it's situated in a world-class, incredible museum. And I would walk through the museum every single day. And I noticed that so many of these masterpieces were featured women, nude women, and they were idealized and submissive and generic, and the makers were male painters. So I thought, well, what would it be like for these subjects to paint their own portraits? And, you know, what were they thinking? And, you know, what would it be like to show some of their flaws instead of just glazing over it and making these bodies seamless and perfect? So using my interest in collage, which had been developing, and also this idea of imbuing art history with a more idiosyncratic and specific viewpoint started to motivate me. So I began to kind of take these paintings and make them my own. And it felt like an homage, but also a critique at the same time, because I love art history and I think it's all one big collaboration. But what would it be like for an art history student to be in the mind of those models and for those models to be their own makers?
And when I go back to the early practice of yours, where did you take the images from you painted? Were they from the internet, or what type of images were you practicing on?
So in college, when I was studying how to refine the painting skills and render and oil paint, I would take those photos myself. And I would take photos of friends, I would take photos of myself, family members. And that was where it began. And I actually still use that material in my paintings today. And in between shows, I'll work on those. I'll make close-up paintings just on a blank canvas and self-sample those in the current work that I make. So I'll do another painting of a nose or an eye, and then that eye will appear in a new body of work. So it's kind of regenerating the source material.
So you were pretty much driven by the male gaze and the sort of view on women, but more than referring to art history in general?
I think both. I think we also live in this time where information is so accessible and there's really no hierarchy anymore. You can just Google search a Rubens painting or an emoji teardrop. Like, it's all leveled. You don't really have to fly across the world to see these masterpieces in person. We see so much through a screen, for better or for worse. And I want to talk about that leveling in my work. I would go to museums with a very nice camera and photograph the work, but now I just use my iPhone because I want it to be pure to my day-to-day existence. So, you know, screenshots or pulling imagery off the internet or going in person to take a photo, it all becomes the same. It's all just stored on my phone. And I think that experience is something that's very unique to this moment.
When do you notice that this is, that sounds like a pretty smooth arrival at your practice. When did you notice that's what you want to do? Or are you still kind of pushing the boundaries?
It's still evolving. Maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I started intentionally pixelating portions of my paintings. And that also speaks to this moment that every digital image we see is made out of pixels. Just like the pop artists would use the dots, the Benday dots that were used in print media, and those dots composed images. Well, pixels compose our images now. So using pixels to reference image quality, but also the idea of censorship too, and how sometimes censorship is used and sometimes it's not, and it's kind of an ill-defined practice. I don't understand why some bodies are censored and when and where, because we all have bodies and we always have. So talking about that too in terms of art history and selecting which bodies are painted and how they're painted. So the pixelation plays into that.
And how far do you go back into art history?
I've gone as far back into the 1400s. I've used these banners called banderoles, and they have it's like Latin text, and there's actually a few of them in this show, Open Casting. And I like the idea of using language but not necessarily knowing what it means. I feel that in the way that we communicate today through texts or emails, so much is lost in translation. You don't have that face-to-face interaction, and you can lose meaning even if words are there. So, yeah, pretty far back. In this show, I think the oldest work is Unequal. We had a deal painting that's based on the theme of unequal lovers. And that was a theme developed in the 1470s in Northern Europe.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's far back. But then also other contemporary heroes appear here and there, right? In open casting, you sort of create a universe out of the perspective or imagination of a young girl, which is traveling through art history and time. How do you find a match? Like, how do you, because you, I mean, it's difficult to describe, of course, but you have references and altogether it's your work and your sort of energy. I find often when you have two figures in a painting, you can really feel somehow the energy between them. And then very artist historically teach people sometimes see a reference in a Renaissance painting or so, but also if not, you see the dynamic between them. And sometimes I also think there is a reference, but then not always there is one. How do you juxtapose these different elements? Do you start from a painting and then combine elements, or do you start from sometimes more from your own intuition and then things come together?
I usually start with one painting and then I break it apart, whether I'm doing that with physical, like cutting, you know, printing the image and then cutting it, or doing it on the computer. And I break it apart and then I rebuild it. So it has like the structure of the original painting. And in terms of the themes of the
show. Like a reference, you mean, right? Like an original reference painting, yeah.
Right. In the painting Papa Knows, that's based on Velázquez's portrait of Pope Innocent that Francis Bacon also interpreted. So I want that painting to be a part of that lineage and reference it. But, you know, taking away the background, figuring out how to make the background my own, make it more personal to me. I used an Edward Hopper painting for that. And, you know, this idea of a little girl dressing up in art history, performing art history, similar to the way that Cindy Sherman is performative in her photography, these paintings are accessorizing in art history. So, you know, similar to a way that you try on a pair of shoes, it doesn't look good with the pants, you take it off, you know, and what does it mean for a garment from the 1600s to be paired with an emoji from 2023 or a hand from a pop artist, and putting it all on one plane, putting all this information out and consolidating it and having it make sense, containing centuries in one field. A lot of mixing and matching and using intuition, but also playing with ideas of representation and how, you know, Cézanne rendered apples versus how Lichtenstein presented them. So like a solid circle equals apple, but a impressionist green orb also equals apple.
And the fact that you're referencing so many male artists, you think that's only due to the fact that they are so dominant in art history?
So that's definitely intentional. And it's a way to kind of roast art history. So it's, you know, it's paying homage, also critiquing and taking it back. It's like an open kind of theft. And I don't pretend that it's my invention. It's all about like sampling, visual sampling and referencing, similar to a way that like in an essay, an author can quote another author and use like in-text citations. So I think today, like especially on social media, there's so many references and so many repostings. And how does that make its way into art? That's a question that I'm always thinking about.
So you are a little bit like this little boy in the Eric Fischer painting stealing from the purse?
Right. Yeah. Bringing it back to the beginning. And yeah, that's amazing. And, knowing I'm doing something, you know, I'm being mischievous.
Let's talk also a bit about your technique, because also what you just said, the way you deal with images and the references, that also reflects in the practice, because you print and paint.
Mm-hmm. Right. And turning, you know, turning it on its head, like what is more irreverent than printing an art historical masterpiece? But I do paint over everything. And the print portion acts as an underpainting. And I modify it a lot. I'll take things out, paint things in. It's kind of like it functions as a guideline. And then just I'll make the painting based off the initial composition, photograph that painting, and then take that photograph back into a new painting. So it's kind of like self cannibalization, and the referencing can become meta. It can be specific, like, you know, just taking an eye from a painting that I've done, or I can take an entire face, an entire body. And to me, it's about keeping the story going. And just like, you know, Picasso painted Dora Maar or Marie Therese over and over again, I like the idea of repainting the same face, but having it change slightly every single time. So the character keeps developing.
But what's interesting is that you sometimes have surfaces or these pixels, which have almost a three-dimensional stucco surface, which are very haptical, which I think makes the work, what is the next topic I want to talk with you about, is how important is the original? I mean, these surfaces and dots and pixels vary depending on from what perspective you look on the painting. But I find it interesting, artists in your generation and maybe mine fading out, because I grew up like half with the internet, but you mentioned the Erik Fischel image, which had such a strong power, like as one example for art in general, which can unfold an amazing power. Interesting, for example, for me was Duchamp's urinal, but also Manzoni's Pedestal of the Earth. So it's like a pedestal in the middle of nowhere, and it's a concrete block, and it says upside down Pedestal of the Earth. So it's like the whole Earth globe is sitting on this pedestal. And I think I was like 14 or so. My parents took me to this place, and it was a little bit of a disappointment, you know, because it's same with the urinal of Duchamp. It's such a strong gesture, but when you see it then physically, of course, you know, the idea is almost better than the result. And how important are originals for you? Because you also leave the painting with like stand up three-dimensional freestanding paintings, which are almost like, how would you describe them? There you get like three-dimensional with your work.
Mm-hmm. Well, to answer your question about the original, I feel like we live in this time where it's like the original either matters so much or it doesn't matter at all, because the internet has made this new kind of reality where we don't know what's real or what's not real. And especially with like the news we receive, it's very hard to verify. So in terms of original, I think the work is playing into this idea of things being modified so much and taken so much from the original source, and they just keep on changing. It's interesting to trace it back, but I think the work is also embracing this idea of fluidity and modification through just how information is moving. And knowing that it isn't the original is what's important to me. Knowing that it came from somewhere, but it's been altered through my own hand and just through this mediation of technology. The sculptures are They are flat sculptures, and they're essentially freestanding paintings. What's interesting to me about them in terms of having them exist in a show exhibition is that depending on where they're placed, it becomes a collage. So the viewer moves through the space, and as they move, what the sculpture is hiding changes. So it becomes like a moving collage. Also, when the sculptures are photographed in front of the paintings, everything flattens out, and it's impossible to tell where the sculpture ends and begins. It becomes a part of the painting as well. So there's this idea of image flattening that is happening in the work, and also referencing like the flatness of our screen. We see so much imagery, but you can turn your phone off and it's just a little black rectangle of a flat quarter inch machine. The sculptures are actually the same width as my iPhone. I thought that was kind of interesting in terms of depth.
But it's interesting. It almost sounds that you are already taking the reception of the exhibition in consideration, that it takes place through social media.
Exactly. I think the majority of people that will see the show will probably see it through a screen. And instead of fighting that, I want to embrace it. And I don't even know if it's better to see it in person, because so much of the art that I see is through a screen. And in person, there is more of a play, and I think the viewer engages in a kind of performance with the work, where they're negotiating their bodies around the sculptures, and they're aware of their own physicality. And the sculptures are unusually shaped, so there is a bit of like an awkward dance that happens, and I want the viewer to be aware of their body in the same way that a subject in a painting is aware of their body.
But that's actually more what I meant with the original. I didn't mean so much original in the sense of copyright mm-hmm. concept idea original, more in the sense of the physical original, because I find that interesting with your work, that it's playing with, I mean, your paintings are a bit like as if you totally doom scrolling an Instagram feed on the history of painting, you know, while being in today's days. But at the same time, the way you execute these works with these different surfaces, but also I find, for example, we have this one standing figure here where there's like a tablecloth which is functioning also as a stand up, you know, so like the figure runs into a structure because these two dimensional paintings need to stand on something. And I think it's so smart how you found a way to somehow incorporate the foot into the painting. And that's why I find interesting some, like, obviously, because you don't do digital art, you don't do immersive, I mean, they're immersive, but you don't like sort of create immersive spaces. You're so up to date, but at the same time, very traditional, right?
Right. Right. And I think painting has always been in conversation with the technology of its day. And I think about how the Impressionists were able to go out to the countryside because of the invention of the trains, and that paint was available in tubes instead of having to grind it up in the studio. And not like the Industrial Revolution made painting portable, which made Impressionism possible. And
plan air, right? In the right. Outside air, yeah.
Right. And just like when photography was invented, painting was declared to be dead, and it's been alive and thriving since. And it acknowledges photography, it acknowledges the cropping of photography, it utilizes it, but painting never went away. And now we're living in a time where we're inundated with images constantly. And it's a barrage. And how do we keep painting? How does painting talk about it? How does painting acknowledge it? And how does painting still stand on its own? So I'm invested in painting, but I'm also curious as to how to acknowledge and utilize the technology we have today, because it's, you know, using your thumbs is very different from rendering with a paintbrush.
And how important you think it is for the viewer to know about art history? Because I find it interesting when we have so many young people visiting the gallery, but also when I go to art schools and speak with degree students, I'm often very surprised they don't really are so interested in the more recent art history, which I think is crucial when you practice, because you, if you join this conversation, you need to know what has been talked about. But from a reception point of view, like from the spectator and the recipients, is it important at all to understand where these influences come from?
I really love Jeff Koons's idea of accessibility and making artwork that anybody can enjoy. I think the more you know about art history, it becomes a different experience when viewing the work. I really want the work to feel playful. And I think no matter somebody's knowledge in art history, they will feel that these paintings have the soul of art history. And I've witnessed viewers saying like, oh, that's Van Gogh, that's a Picasso. And to me, that feels, you know, very, that kind of art history is almost universal. But the more you know, the more fun it can be. And depending on like your knowledge of art history, you can say, oh, that's, you know, a Starry Night in from Van Gogh. You can name the title, you can get more specific, you can figure out, it's one thing to, you know, figure out the movement, but then you can understand the artist, maybe even the subject, if it was a subject that appeared over and over in the work. It's not, I don't think having a deep understanding of art history will make the work more legible to somebody. I think there's so much to grab onto that it can appeal to people with a huge knowledge of art history or no knowledge.
You mentioned the Impressionists, and your work is quite known, I would say the in most part figurative. You explored also still life, landscape, and other like classical painting themes.
Right. Taking like a George Condo painting, and George Condo has been influenced by Picasso or El Greco, and like reaching back into that history, but putting it all out there. So, or even with the Francis Bacon Pope painting, taking it from the original. And I didn't use Francis Bacon's interpretation, but I did want to harness the feeling of it, so to make it more unsettling. Velázquez's Pope does not feel the same way that Francis Bacon's Pope does.
I was wondering if we can expect from you more journeys into other sort of genres like landscape or still life or abstract, because you pretty much focused on figurative painting.
I think using all of these different visual languages plus pixelation is actually taking me towards abstraction. And when I zoom out from the paintings, they start to turn into a more abstract field. And I'm very excited by that idea, that obliterating the imagery by using so much imagery might take the work into a place where there really is no discernible figuration.
So at what point did you started with these freestanding sculptures? Because it seems like consequently you're going to get even more immersive.
I like the idea of set design. I have some fantasies of creating, as you mentioned, landscape, a gigantic landscape, and then have the figures actually exist as sculptures. So no figures within the painting itself, but figures that exist as freestanding sculptures, and opening it up for the viewer to move the sculptures themselves. So it becomes interactive and very much a non-static experience.
And on the photography, again, it's again like a painting, right?
Right, exactly. So when it's photographed, you could change the scene entirely. You know, you can congregate the figures on one side, or, you know, each one could interact with each other in a very different way with every iteration. You could change the meaning.
Which makes me think that actually more art historical, maybe just not in my feed, are not really so present in social media, right?
Right. Sometimes, you know, I'll see a meme where it's like photo of like a party and they'll say, this looks like a Renaissance painting. And like, that's the closest to art history that, that, you know, silly social media can reach towards. But I think, you know, social media is a very powerful tool, and, you know, it could sway political movements, and it's not something to be taken lightly.
No, consolidate banks within 24 hours, like what right. we saw with Credit Suisse. Maybe at the end of this conversation, let's speak again about open casting, the title of your exhibition here. Open casting sounds like an open call for actors to audit, I would say, or how mm-hmm. is that to interpret it?
Yes, exactly. I like the idea of open sourcing, using Wikipedia and how anybody can contribute and it can be verified and people working together. Because I'm using so much of art history, I consider it a collaboration, and I'm open sourcing art history. And the feeling of openness, of being open to art movements, to any kind of character can enter into the painting. And of course, the idea of performance. So these paintings are dressing up in art history. These paintings are acting as art history. They're not art history, but they're play acting. And I really like the idea of storytelling. I thought a lot about the Grimm's brothers, actually, because of this show being in Germany and being in Berlin, and how so many of those stories are compilations of stories, and the Grimm's brothers put those stories together and then presented them as one tale. And then Disney comes along and takes those stories and reinterprets them. So looking at Disney, looking at Grimm's brothers, and also presenting that. And, you know, there's cartooning in the paintings. There's lots of references to Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, and combining that with the feel of a German forest.
But it's interesting what you say about the Grimm brothers, because as you said, they collected all these myths and stories which were sort of in the public domain,
right,
and preserved them. And then also there was Gutenberg, who developed the technology to print books. But today, for example, the Grimm fairy tales are totally changed, of course, because they are so, I don't know, maybe it was a misunderstanding and they were never really for children because they're quite cruel.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, and have been washed out a little bit.
Exactly. So I think the work also speaks to that, you know, changing and modifying and consolidating, combining, reinterpreting.
And it's a bit like a filter too, no? Like an art history filter.
Yes.
Great. I hope we were able to transform some thoughts. I'm very impressed how you took us through the journey of the paintings, which is hard enough, I think, on pure communication. Alison, thank you so much. And I look forward to see a big land art project of paintings in the landscape.
Thank you. This was so enjoyable. Thank you for your time.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.